Welcome, everyone, to our first class from the book of Shemos, Chumash Shemot, the second book of the Chamisha Chumshei Sora, A Rose by Any Other Name. Little Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet. Ve'ela Shemos B'nei Yisrael, and these are the names of the children of Israel. Habaim Mitzrayim, who were coming to the land of Egypt. Es Yaakov, along with Jacob. Ish Uvesel Bao, each man and his household, they came. Shemot, of course, literally means names. The book of names. So although Christian scholars like to call it the book of Exodus, because the main, perhaps the greatest moment is the Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus from Egypt. Nevertheless, the book literally is the book of names. So what I would like to focus on tonight is if it's a book of names, something perhaps is rotten in the land of Denmark. Sorry, I can't resist Shakespeare tonight. So let's look at quote number two. And these are the names of the sons of Israel. Now, whenever we begin a parsha or a section of Torah with a vav, vav could be a vav hachibur, which is an addition to what happened before, whereas it could also go back to pasul, to sort of retroactively say what was before is there, but this is new stuff. But clearly, there is a connection between the end of Vayechi, where we have announced that Joseph and all his brothers are dead. And of course, it's very, very profound. People miss this. The book of Vayechi ends, Genesis, as we spoke about earlier tonight, with the death of the generation. The original 12 sons of Israel are dead. Joseph died actually earlier on. Levi was the last of the Shvatim, of the tribes. And after Levi's death, then and only then does the process of the avdus, of the slavery, begin. But it ends in a very, almost like a final slam of a coffin lid, because Joseph's body is interred in the Nile River. And of course, Pharaoh did this by design, because he said, you know, I think Joseph made you all swear a solemn Shavua that you would take his remains out of Egypt to be interred in the land of Israel, in the city of Shechem, which I believe is Nablus in the English vernacular, in Shechem. And so if you can't take Joseph's remains, because the Nile happens to be 4,000 miles or so long, with some nice crocodiles and other assorted carnivores to predate you, then you're not going to leave. So Joseph is slammed into the bottom, the depths of the Nile, and the water, you can almost visually see this, the water is just closing over Joseph. And the last thing he swore to the Jewish people, Pakod yifkod Elokim eschem. Remember, Joseph said, he adjured them, God will surely remember you. Now, of course, that phrase, God will surely remember you, was given by Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, in the beginning of Exodus, of Shemos, to validate that he is the Goel, the will-be Redeemer, chosen by God. And there's one old lady, Sarah, who's still alive, who remembered that phrase. She remembered the original promise, but what's more remarkable, it's beautiful, very poetic. So if we're speaking Shakespeare tonight, this is the poetry part that I want to get to. You have the waters taking Joseph's body to the depths. Hope is lost, so to speak. But who takes shape from those same waters that becomes Moses? So the next book begins almost as a juxtaposition. You have Joseph's body going in, Moshe's little baby body being taken out by Princess Bisya. Unbelievable. And what's more remarkable? You know this answer. Who was the only Jew who remembered the oath to take Joseph's body out of the land of Egypt? It's Moshe. On the night of Passover, Makas Bechoros, the night of the death of the firstborn, we're all sitting around having our Manischewitz Matzah and our Maror, and everyone is then claiming massive amounts of jewelry and such from their Egyptian hosts. I use that, of course, in a very light term. Right? Moses doesn't get any money. No loot for Moses. Why? He's walking up and down the banks of the Nile River trying to locate with a GPS. Maybe he had Google Maps or Waze. He's trying to locate Joseph's location of the burial. He finds the coffin and he brings Joseph out. God says, interestingly, at the end of Moshe's life, by the way, Moses, because you forsook the money and you bothered yourself to find Joseph's remains, I will take care of you in the end. And God himself buries Moses at the end of Moses' life as a payback. So you have this amazing juxtaposition between the redemption, the hope of redemption, Joseph, the finality of the Parsha ending and the Chumash ending. And then you have immediately Moses being drawn forth, which is his name, Moses, from the depths of the same water to save the Jews, to save Joseph, to redeem Joseph. And then God redeems Moses. So it's all a beautiful circle. Okay.
But isn't there a whole other story about Pharaoh and the gods of the river?
Absolutely. And absolutely. Thank you, Doc. So let's look at number two. And these are the names of the sons of Israel. Ve'ela Shemos B'nei Israel, a direct quote from the first verse of the Parsha and of the Chumash. Although God counted them in their lifetime by their names. Stop, just keep your finger there. Meaning at the end of Vayichi, the blessings, of course, each tribe Jacob blesses according to the mission and the identity of each tribe. So we know the tribes. So why reiterate their names? Because God loves them. It's almost like a little kid with his baseball card collection or his marble collection. He wants to keep taking it out and looking at each precious marble, each precious baseball card, you know, his Ty Cobb rookie card or his Babe Ruth. And he keeps counting and counting them. So that's what Hashem does. Because God counted them again after their death to let us know how precious they, meaning the tribes of Israel, are to God. Because they were likened to the kochavim, to the stars, which God takes out from beyond the horizon and brings in by number and by name. And as it is said in Isaiah, in the book of Yeshaya, who takes out their host by name, all of them he calls by name. So let's stop for a second. You have a book of names. You have the very first Rashi, on the very first word, Shemos, the names, questioning, what's with the names? We already know who they are. No, because names are a definitive way of relating to someone. Stars, superstars, people. What if there was a book of names that was actually sans names? That would be kind of odd, wouldn't it? Well, we're going to see this tonight and try to understand this tonight. So before we go on, let's talk about what a name means. Again, today we name people after people who are deceased. If you're Sephardic, you don't even have to wait for the person to be dead, right? Because Sephardim have a custom, believe it or not. It's not our custom. It's not the Ashkenazi custom. But they will actually, you know, have like a George Foreman situation, right? George Foreman number one, George Foreman number two, right? So they will name someone for the living. We, Ashkenazim, only do it for the dead. But as a tribute to Zadie, to Bubby, to our dear uncle, someone of significance that we hope to bestow those ideals and those midos, those beautiful attributes on our little precious little baby. Okay, but what about the originators of those names? So let's go way back. Avraham, Av Hamon Goyim, the father of a multiplicity of nations. Sarah, princess for the world. They're the avot, the archetypes of the Jewish people. So each and every person, for good, bad, or ugly, who has a name in the Chumash in the Torah, has a name based on something of their character. So, for example, the nefarious Bilam, Bili'am, a man without a people, a man without a nation. He was sort of like your gunslinger for hire, which he really was, Bilam. So every name in the Torah describes something. Moshe. It's an Egyptian name, not given by his own mom and dad, by Bisya, princess, daughter of Pharaoh. Why? Because Min Hamayim Ishisu, I drew him forth from the water. That is the name God refers to Moshe by only this and nothing else. So we see then that names are definitive of who we are, character. But more than this, you probably have all been at Minyanim, and everyone's looking around saying, do we have a quorum? We got a Minyan, right? And what do? They say, Hoshia, Esamecho, Varech, Esnach, Lasecho, and then you get the guy who's not so smart going, Ureim, 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 Venasem, Ureim. Okay, it repeats itself about 12 times. Okay. You have 20 people in a minion. So we count Jews by, not number, but because we don't want to take away their names, we refer to them by a pasuk in the Torah, a verse in the Torah, to describe who they are. We don't dare count 1, 2, 3, 4, because we count animals that we slaughter. We do not count human beings. So such is the nature, the gravitas of the name, of a shame, that we dare not refer to somebody by a number. And of course, we all know that Shikelgruber, Yimach Shemo, what was the first thing he did to exterminate our people? He stripped away our names and gave us numbers. Because you don't kill a nation, 6 million names, individuals, children, and Zadies, but when animals have a tattooed number on them, they go to slaughter. Right? I think I shared with you this. I have once had a Mr. Schwartz, Oliver Shalom, in my first pulpit in Canada, outside of Toronto. He's a farmer, and he raised big animals, steer and such, for slaughter. They weren't the cuddly type of little Bessie the cow, you know, the milk cow. They specifically were raised and they were sold off for slaughter. So I remember I asked him a question. It was a rhetorical question because I really knew the answer. But I needed to hear it from him. I said, Mr. Schwartz, tell me, do you ever name your animals? He said, no, Rabbi, never. I said, please help me. Why? He says, because they're going to be slaughtered. So as soon as you name Bessie the cow, Bessie the cow, all the little Kinderlach in the farm are like, what happened to Bessie tonight as they're eating their hamburger, right? And you could only imagine if mom and dad says, well, Bessie didn't have a timely end. I'm sorry. You're going to have a lot of vegetarians for the rest of their lives. It'll be a shattery moment. So it's clear that even the way we relate to people and to animals, when we give our dogs and our cats and our beloved pets names, they almost become a member of the mishpacha, right? Because we're giving them an identity.
Almost.
Or more, right? More than the names of animals. So please keep this in mind, because shemos, then, are not just a definition of the essence of a person's character in Jewish law. It's really the essence of a human being, of humanity. Humans have names, animals, ostensibly, except for the animals that we love, do not. Yes?
I know a local farmer who named their animals Burger, Roast, Chops. That way, they never had a worry.
Aye.
That's why they named their animals on the farm. They're having roast for dinner tonight. Oh, okay.
Aye.
There'll be no
roast.
So let's look at source number three. Source number three are the first 10 verses of the second parak, the second chapter in the book of Exodus. Shemos, Kumash Shemos, the Parsha Shemos. And I could have done this in Hebrew, but it's easier just to read it in English. Now, you know how difficult it is when you read verses and they use a lot of pronouns. He and she, and you're kind of in the middle, you're thinking, who's the he and who's the she and who are they, right? That's why whenever I'm translating for you, I either parenthetically show you the names, because it gets a little tiresome and a little lost in translation. So let's just look at how we are introduced to Moses and the supernatural birth of Moses. Let's just look. I'll just read it to you, okay? Tell me what's missing here. A man of the house of Levi went and married the daughter of Levi.
No names.
The woman conceived and bore a son. She saw that he was good, and she kept him hidden for 3 months. When she could no longer hide him, she took a papyrus box, coated it with clay and tar. She placed the child in it and placed it in the reeds near the bank of the river. His sister, and you have to add the little fake out, the parenthetical child sister, because we don't know who you're talking about. His sister, meaning the baby's sister, stood herself at a distance to see what would happen to him. Oh, we get a name. Pharaoh. Great. Hitler's daughter went down to bathe by the river because, you know, Pharaoh committed genocide, the first to ever practice genocide against the Jewish people. He was the role model, unfortunately, for Hitler. So we call her Hitler's daughter. Essentially, that's the remarkable nature of her righteousness, that her father could decree the infanticide against the Jewish baby boys, and yet she, from that same household, nourishes the Redeemer. So Pharaoh's daughter went down to bathe by the river while her maids walked along the river's edge. She saw the box among the reeds and sent her maid, and she fetched it. She opened it and saw the child, and behold, a boy was crying. She took pity on it and said, this is one of the Hebrew boys. His sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call to you a nursing mother from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you, go, said Pharaoh's daughter to her. The young girl went, called the child's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, the child's mother, because we don't even know who we're talking about at this point, take this child and nurse him for me, and I will pay your fee. The woman took the child, nursed it, and when the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. Finally, we get a name, Mazel Tov. She named him Moshe, Moses, for she said, I drew him from the water. Oh, my gosh. Now, you probably didn't even notice this because it's exciting. It's the birth of Moses. But until you strip it to its essence, it is stunning. For example, if you would just use names, and we'll discuss who these people are in a moment, the cast of characters, it's a whole lot easier than keep having to have these narrative descriptions and the sister of the child, right? You're adding so many more words because you refuse stubbornly to even refer to the people, the characters, by their names. So it's actually adding to the difficulty, adding words to a Torah that is always written the most succinct and terse way possible. God is not verbose in his communique. If anything, it's the opposite to the extreme. Very problematic. Do you want to say something, Mrs. Minkoff? Oh, I thought you had a comment. So, let's now talk about who these characters are. Maybe they're not worthy of name. Well, let's see. A man of the house of Levi went, and he married a girl. A man went and married a girl. Do you know who the man was? His name was Amram. You know who Amram was? He was the Gadol Hador. How do you like that? He was the Rabbi Soloveitchik times 10 of all the land of the world for the Jewish population. Moses' father, Amram, was the greatest tzaddik in the world. According to the Gemara, never sinned in his whole life. Died only because of the sin of the snake in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve. So we're talking about Amram, the greatest rabbi of Egypt, the chief rabbi of Egypt, but he's just a man from the house of Levi. And he marries the daughter of Levi. Yeah, this young girl went on a date. They met at a shidduch in Frumster, and they went out and they got married. You know who she is? She's Yocheved. Yocheved, who was literally the daughter of Levi, the tribes, one of the greatest, most righteous women to ever live. In fact, she's one of the nurses who defied Pharaoh's decree that they should kill the babies when they're on the birth stool. She stood up to Pharaoh, manipulated Pharaoh, won against Pharaoh, and thousands of Jewish boys were saved because of the righteousness that's there. But she's just a daughter of Levi. Okay, file that away. And then it talks about the fact that she has a child, and there's a sister involved. Gee, who is this? How about Miriam? How about Miriam HaNeviah, the prophetess? Miriam the prophetess who led the women at the Sea of Reeds, at the Kriyas Yam Suf, the splitting of the sea, she's the one who had the musical instruments and leads the women as Moses is leading the men in the Azishir Moshe of Israel, the Song of the Sea. Miriam is leading the women. She marries Kalev, one of the two spies who comes back with truthful reports against the other 10 who were committed to destroying the land of Israel at that time. And, of course, Miriam is the one that all the Jewish people wait for when she becomes a leper because she spoke badly against Moses. But she's just the sister. She's just a sister. And then we have the daughter of Pharaoh comes along, right? She's just a daughter of Pharaoh. Really? Her name was either Basia or Bisia, depending on how you look at the Midrash. And who was Basia? Well, there's a whole section, apparently, of heaven named after this glorious woman. Because this glorious woman has Hitler for a father, and yet she defies her own father, risks her own life, and the lives of all those who are in love with her. She rescues Moses, brings Moses to live in the palace under Pharaoh's own roof. But she's just princess. She's just the daughter of Pharaoh. What do we care, right? Again, it's insane. Now, if this was not the Book of Names, you could say, well, there must be something else going on here. We don't really understand. But the fact that it's Shemos, the Book of Names, and the fact that it is literally a roster of the greatest, the finest, the best that Egypt had to offer is a little strange, to say the least. We have to understand this. Okay? Number four. Okay, but you might say, but Rabbi, wait a minute. In the first chapter, there actually are some names. They're the midwives that you refer to, the nurses who stood up to Pharaoh. Pharaoh's first plan, slavery. Second plan, kill the boys with the assistance of the midwives, the nurses, and then and only then cast the young Jewish boys into the Nile River. So plan two didn't work. Why didn't it work? Because Yocheved, this wonderful daughter of Levi, and little Miriam, who were the midwives, stood up to Pharaoh and said, no, nothing doing. In fact, Batichayena Esa Yeladim, they specifically went out of their way to give life to the little baby boy. So thousands were saved. So number four. Now the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one who was named Shifra, who's my mother-in-law, and the second who was named Pua. Well, wait a minute, I thought you said it's Yocheved and Miriam. Well, yeah, but we don't give them real names. We give them like Winnie the Pooh, right? They're fake names. They're just little cute names. Why are they cutesy names? Why are they called Shifra? Ah, Rashi tells us number five. Shifra was Yocheved. Why was she called Shifra? Why was she given this very strange name? Because she beautified Misha Peres Esavlad. When the little boys would come, it wasn't enough that she saved their lives, but she would dress them up in, you know, nice little matching blue little outfits, and if they looked a little schmushy, as babies sometimes do when they're born, she unschmushed them and made them look very cute and palatable for mom and dad. And Pua, who was this Winnie the Pua character? Well, that was little Miriam. Why is she called Pua? Because she cried out, Po'a, and talked and cooed to the little newborn infant in the manner of women who soothe a crying infant. So again, Shifra and Pua are really Yocheved and Miriam with playful little names, which shows how much love they had as midwives. Not only did they save the babies, but they went out of their way to act like mothers to each and every baby, to the point of holding them and comforting the babies. Wow. But that they're not given real names. Very strange. So in other words, you have an entire book called Shmos, names, but no names, just pronouns. And the only names you give us are fake-out names, Shifra and Pua. What is going on? What's going on? All right. So let's look at the book of Ruth. We learned this last year in depth. Let's look at Megillat Ruth, the magnificent book of Ruth that we read right before Shavuos. And it's the story, of course, really of the life of King David, even though David is only referred to in the very tail end of the story. It's really that beautiful saga of Ruth, the Moabitess, her amazing journey to become Jewish, and that she becomes the mother of Malchus, of all of the kings of Judah. Okay, let's look at number six, please. You will be struck, amazingly, by the fact that Samuel, Shmuel Hanavi, who wrote this magnificent book, plagiarizes our Chumash Shmos that we read in source number one. Have a look at this. See if there's an echo here that resonates with you. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges judged that there was a famine in the land, and a man, these are the critical words here, and a man went from Bethlehem of Judah to sojourn in the fields of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. Then the next verse goes on to say, oh, by the way, the name of the man was the richest guy. He was the Steve Jobs of his generation. His name was Elimelech. And his wife? Oh, well, you may know her also, because she is essentially the mother of kings, Naomi. Ah, you heard of her? And they had two sons, and they named the two sons. It's so horribly written that the first verse is like, if you look up the word non sequitur in your dictionary, this verse is right there. It's so horribly written that poor Samuel has to come in verse 2 and then now identify who's the man, who's the wife, and who are the two sons. Now, if Samuel borrows the literary device that we have in these first psukim in Exodus, he obviously does this knowingly because the book of Exodus was written by God. Samuel is inspired by God. So clearly he is trying to almost draw what they call gzeirah shavah, almost like a direct comparison between Exodus and the book of Ruth. But why? To what effect? So maybe if we get to the bottom of the no-name nonsense, we can try to understand then better why there should be this parallel construct, if you will, between the book of Ruth and the book of Exodus. Okay? So before I try to give you an approach, does anybody have any thoughts? Yes, Dr. Cohen.
Well, one thought I have is that even though these were great people and everything was wonderful, the actual story is the miracle of the birth of Moshe is being found. It's kind of like when you watch the, what was that movie? 2010. They had the music and they all just rock out of the, and it builds up and the monkeys and everything. And all of a sudden, boom! Suddenly there's a whole awakening. It's the whole thing building up to it. Mm-hmm. Right before, it doesn't really count.
Interesting.
As important as they are, they don't really count. They
because the point is the end of the journey.
It's the end of the journey.
Okay. It's a good approach. Good approach. I like it. Anyone else want to offer any ideas? It's kind of a strange, strange situation, isn't it?
Okay. So let me share with you a thought, an approach. Not the only one, again, but something I have from my Rebbe, Rabbi Weinberg. It is so egregiously obvious that God, Hashem, who writes this book, is telling us no names right now, in a book of names, that it must be telling us something of the nature of redemption. Because these are the verses that give us Moses the Redeemer, the first Moshiach, the first Savior of the Jewish people. So you can't escape the idea that somehow his birth, as you said, is not just magical, but it is something maybe out of the hands of man, preordained. Now, we know, we struggle with this concept. We have preordination. God ordains that something will happen. Well, if God ordains that something will happen, doesn't that impact and perhaps even steal from us the most precious gift that God gives us, which is freedom of choice? Because if it's preordained, then where do I fit in? Where's my life? You can't take away my freedom of choice and still have preordination, can you? Well, yes. Maybe you can. Let's discuss this for a moment. When we get together on Passover, in the night of the Seder, you may remember these words. It says, "Vahi b'chatzi halayla." It was in literally the chatzi, the middle of the night. The Bechorim, the firstborn, the eldest of all the Egyptians, animals, people, they are all wiped out. And it was the moment that God waited for. And in fact, the rabbis go further. They say it was literally to the millisecond. Not 1 second earlier or later. 2448, 2,448 years since the creation of man, you have this magical moment that was preordained. Now, again, the moment of the Exodus was preordained. But what was not preordained? How the Exodus would be accomplished? Through whom it would be accomplished? Well, that was yet to be decided. In fact, when Genesis opens, we don't even know who the Jewish people are going to be. It wasn't until Jacob comes, wrestles the angel, and wins the mantle of Israel that we can say, oh, well, he's Israel then, and his children are the Bnei Israel. Until the moment of Jacob's supremacy, that fateful night, it's not even clear who Israel's going to be. And of course, the nations of the world until this day don't really accept necessarily who Israel is. Think about this. It's fascinating. Most of you have visited Israel? Jerusalem? So you may know that Jerusalem is divided into four what they call rovas, four sections. You have the Jewish section, the rova Yehudi, correct? And then you have the Muslim quarter, and you have the Christian quarter. You know what that fourth quarter is? It's very bizarre. You see them walking up and down with their black Armenian quarter. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the Bible, look at the Chumash, it's fascinating. Because who are the four nations that all lay claim to Israel? It's fascinating. You have the Jewish people, right? You have the Muslims through Ishmael. You have the Christians and the ideology of Jesus. You also have, though, Laban, the Arameans, Laban. Because remember, all the Jewish women, Rebecca, even Sarah came from that part of the world, but Rebecca for sure, Rachel, Leah for sure, are literally Arameans, right? So it's not a small issue. It's interesting that the four quarters of the holiest city of the world all kind of fight over who is Israel. And remember, the people don't say, well, we're not Israel. They all believe they're Israel. So let's get back to Israel then. So when Israel becomes Israel, because Jacob wins it in battle, okay, that is a seminal moment that defines the nature of the Jewish people versus the title of Israel. But what about the night of Passover? We spoke about the night being preordained. And how do we know it's preordained? Because it, in that very first verse, Bereshit, it already alludes to a moment, HaChodesh HaZeh Lechem. When was the new moon given? while they're slaves in the land of Egypt. So we know that from the very moment of Genesis, when God creates the world, the universe, you're already looking forward to the moment of Passover. It's preordained. Okay, but we said, what is preordained? That there will be a redemption from slavery. Where does human choice come in? The casting call. Who are going to step up and say, I'm ready. I will make this happen. So we know that the casting call went out in Egypt, okay? We know that Charlton Heston and some others, they won the role, magically. Yul Brynner, by the way, he was good. You know, Yul Brynner, in my humble opinion, was even better than Ramses. I think he would be proud. I shared that story with you, right? If I didn't, I'll share the story. I had a very, very good friend in Yeshiva named Alan Teichman. Alan Teichman was very well-to-do family, multi-millionaires. And he was taking flying lessons out of Ontario Airport, Los Angeles, private lessons. So he walks into the little terminal to sign out his airplane, and he looks up, and the real Yul Brynner walks in. Whoa, so my, you know, it's very recognizable, this is Yul Brynner. So my friend Avram Teichman, Alan looks at him, and he looks at Teichman, takes in the fact he's wearing a little kippah sukkah, a little knit yarmulke on his head. He's obviously a Jew. So my friend Teichman says, you know, Mr. Brynner, it's an honor to meet you. Would it be possible to have your autograph? So Mr. Brynner looks at him and takes the pen and takes the paper, and then he puts on the voice. So should it be written, so should it be done. And he proceeds to sign the autograph for my friend Teichman.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Doc.
You talk about preordained, preordained, preordained. So the fight with the angel was preordained. That Yaakov would win was preordained. I mean, where do you draw the line and say, this is preordained,
excellent.
And this isn't?
We're going to address this. So let's just step back for a moment. We have the big, big moments woven into Genesis. In other words, I pointed out to you, I proved to you, to everyone, hopefully, that even at that very first verse, Bereshit, that one word, is already an allusion, at least according to Rashi, to Passover, the Exodus. Okay. So Dr. Kelman's asking, if everything is preordained, then where's human choice?
No, I'm not saying that's my
question. No, but let me just throw it out to you. What constitutes the big picture? You have universal preordained moments.
May I?
Please allow me to do that, and we'll come back. So here is a preordained moment. The night of Passover. It's a preordained moment. There's going to be, at the literally, as the clock ticks midnight, Exodus is going to happen. Now, what is not preordained? Moses, Aaron, Miriam, the fantastic women, the Nashim Tzikonios, the righteous women of that generation that kept everything, all the hope and all the faith. That is not preordained. In other words, there's an open casting call. What if Moses had debated by the bush for another little bit? Maybe God would have said, you know, Moses, you're not the right person. I thought you were. It's got to be someone else. And it could have been somebody else. That's the amazing thing. It could have been someone else, right? It didn't have to be Moses, Miriam, and Aaron. But that's the point, is that there are moments that God preordains as part of the fabric of creation itself. I'll give you another one. Story of Purim. It's brought down in Talmud and such that the moment that we are under the threat of extermination from Haman, there's a casting call that goes out. And Mordechai, and I pointed this out when we were in the book, Mordechai senses that there's a casting call. And he goes to his beloved cousin, Miss Queen Esther, and says, you know, Esther, there's a casting call here. Esther says, I don't want to go in. I'm going to get my head chopped off by this lunatic, maniacal king. Ahasuerus is going to kill me. I'm not going in. He says, okay, fine. Don't go. It's not a response, by the way, that you think. Normally you think like a pep talk. No, Esther, you must go. After all, you know, we don't know. Maybe this is the reason you became the queen. But he basically says, you know what, Esther? You're right. If you don't have the courage to go, so don't go. But remember something, and it's going to cost you. At ubeit avich tovedu. You and your family, boom, gone. From ever. From history. There's a casting call. So what does that mean? What that means is, if Esther's not up to it, then someone else will be up to it. There will be no Megillat Esther. We'll be reading the Megillat Harry, Megillat Bob, whoever it is, right? It'll be someone else. Or even better, it could just be a generic salvation. God says, oh, well, nobody answered the casting call? It's okay. I don't need to call Lou Wasserman over at Universal. I will just kill Haman in his sleep. Achashverosh, some Huns or something will come over the wall, and before next 13th of Adar, all will be forgotten because there won't be a kingdom to exterminate any more Jews. So it'll just happen because I preordained that it's going to happen. It won't be Esther, won't be Mordechai, we'll never have a book called Esther. All right. But what if the same thing happened, let's say, in Egypt? Let's say there's no Moses, there's no Aaron, there's no Miriam. There's still going to be an Exodus. It just won't be through these magical people. When we strip away the names, we're showing God ordained that this should happen, not the individuals.
Yeah.
They're wonderful, and it's great that they stepped up to the plate. But the magic of the creation of the actual redemption, that's on God. God put out a casting call, and it's just a man from the house of Levi, and he married a daughter of Levi, and it's just a boy. But it could have been you, and it could have been me. And it's telling us something profound, that there are moments in human history, in Jewish history and human history, that are open casting calls. And we have to be sensitive to those moments. And we have to step up. Let me give you one more moment. I can't resist. Because it comes to us courtesy of this last source of the book of Ruth. Why is the book of Ruth parallel, by the way? Because it's the redemption, the final redeemer. It's David's yichus, his genealogy, right? David, who is King David? Mashiach ben David, the final redeemer, the Messiah, son of David. So it has to have the same parallel structure. Moses is the first redeemer of the Jews from the Exodus situation. King David's great-grandchild, Mashiach ben David, will be the last redeemer. So Samuel plagiarizes it to show how similar they are, that there's an open casting call. Now, do you remember the book of Ruth that we learned? How amazing in that fourth chapter, there was a man who could have been Moses, who could have been Esther, who could have been Ruth. Remember what his name was? His name was Tov, Mr. Good. And they said to him, hey, Tov, you're a good guy, right? I mean, your name's Tov. You got to be good. How would you like to marry Ruth? Who's Ruth? The Moabitess. Me? Marry a convert from a malign nation of Moab? Oh my gosh! My children that I would have with her, they won't be allowed into the yeshiva day school system. They're going to say, oh no, what? Who's the mother? No, you can't move to Israel. We're not going to accept you as a Jew. I don't want that stigma on my family. Boaz. Boaz. He could do this. I won't do this. So Samuel says, oh, you mean you don't want to step up? Okay, fine. Do you know the name of Tov does not even appear in the entire book of Ruth? What is he called? Do you remember his name? It's a cute name. Plony Almoni. John Doe. John Doe. We take a little tag, we put it on his cadaver with a little thing. Plony Almoni. John Doe. So-and-so. He's not a real person. Because you had your kick at the can, Mr. Tov, Mr. Good. You were so worried about your future that you're not even going to have a future. Your name is going to be like a butt of a joke. People are going to say, oh, Mr. Plony Almoni, so-and-so, such-and-such a guy, because you didn't have the courage to step up. The same thing would have been true, God forbid, by Esther and Mordechai. The same thing could have been true by Moses. Now, you may ask, but that doesn't help me. How do I know there's a casting call? It's a great question. I can't answer that question. But I can tell you this. If you look around our world today, I don't think it's very far out to say there's a lot of forces moving, good, bad, and ugly, everywhere we look. There's opportunities for us. And I think if we will just look for those opportunities, and again, in answer to Dr. Kelman's question, again, I can't answer what events exactly are preordained and how we quantify an event as preordained, but clearly Passover, the situation with Purim, undoubtedly, are those seminal events. In our own lifetime, do we have such events? Sure. Whether it's 67, the War of Independence, I think when we look back, those were amazing people. They were, remember the American, Mickey, they made the movie about him, right? Yes, thank you. He's somebody, Mickey Marcus, who heard the casting call, right? And he stepped up. He was there. So again, in our own lifetimes, we can have casting calls. We just have to be open to God's will. We have to understand that we have a place in creation. We just have to look for what that possibility is. So just to clarify again, no names, because God ordained that this should happen. But within the universal application of God's preordination, we have Moses' birth, and then you have the acquisition of eternity by Moses, Miriam, and Aaron through their amazing choices, their ability to step up to the casting call, to have the courage, the determination to be the ones. We should all emulate them in their success. And we also, God willing, in our lives, in a positive way, will have our little role to play in the ultimate redemption, that Mashiach ben David that we've been waiting for. And I wish everyone Erev